Good evening. Thank you all for coming, and welcome to the CIPL seminar series for 2025-26. My name's Lionel Bentley. I'm a professor of intellectual property law here, and thankfully, I'm not speaking tonight. Instead, Andrew Christie, professor from the University of Melbourne, is going to be presenting to you. Andrew has been visiting the Centre of Intellectual Property Law and the Centre of Law, Medical and Life Sci Law, Medicine and the Life Sciences here in Cambridge this month. And he's somebody who has a long history with the University of Cambridge. He did his undergraduate degrees in Melbourne and then came to study for the LLM at the University of London and came to Cambridge to do a PhD. And out of his PhD, he wrote a book on a topic that now somehow doesn't seem quite as relevant as it did at the time, the law relating to integrated circuits of semiconductor chip topographies, something like that, which were actually very interesting laws in the early 1990s, because not only were they at the technological frontier, but they were in between copyright, patents, designs, etc. So they were a very interesting topic, and I think probably a great grounding for anybody who was going to be an intellectual property scholar. Andrew went back to Melbourne and became a professor of intellectual property law there, and he became one of the possibly the leading intellectual property scholar in Australia for the last sort of decades. It's great to have him back. He's come back from time to time in the years since the 1990s. Great to have him back again, and we're really looking forward to hearing what he's got to say about patents for well-being. So, Andrew, thank you for coming and thank you for talking.
Well, thank you, Lionel, and thanks to your centre for co-hosting this visit and to Kathy Liddell's Centre for Medicine, Law and Life Sciences for the other co-host of the visit. Particularly, though, thanks to those of you in the room. It's good to see such a number of you in the room, those online, and indeed those online who are watching this after the event as recording. You are giving me the most valuable thing you can. It's your attention, your time, your engagement. So thank you for that. I really appreciate that. And I will endeavour to reward your investment of your time, your commitment, your engagement with some things that I hope you'll find relevant and interesting, but I encourage you to maximize that by asking questions, making comments both as we go as well as at the end. You may want to reflect and then ask questions or comments at the end, but if something occurs to you now, just whack your hand up and I'll happily hear what you've got to say, and if it's a question, attempt to answer it. The genesis for the topic is, I would normally not start by saying the genesis for the topic. It's not very relevant usually, but it is in this case. The genesis for this topic was a phone call that I received a few years ago from the president of the Institute of Patent and Trademark Attorneys of Australia, which is the Australian equivalent of CIPA, the Chartered Institute of Patent Agents here in the UK, the body that represents that profession, the patent attorney profession. And indeed, it's a cognate profession to law. If you find yourself practicing IP and part of that practice involves patents, you'll be dealing with patent attorneys inevitably. Anyway, the president rang and said she'd just been listening to the radio in Australia and heard that the New Zealand equivalent of the Chancellor of the Exchequer was about to hand down tomorrow New Zealand's well-being budget. And there was discussion about what a well-being budget is. And she thought, this is an interesting development. And her institute, her members, Patent and Trademark Attorneys of Australia, should hear about it at the forthcoming conference. So she rang and said, Andrew, would you come and talk to us about well-being economics? And I said, yeah, sure, no worries. Got off the phone. My wife said, who was that? I said, that was president of the institute. What did she want? She wanted me to speak at a conference. Did you say yes? I said yes. And then my wife said, and what's the topic? And I said, I don't know. I have absolutely no idea what she's talking about. But I like to be invited. In fact, I particularly like to be invited to speak about things on which I know nothing, because I then force myself to learn. And the older I get, there's nothing more rewarding, interesting, exciting than to continue to learn. You know that as younger learners, younger than me, that is, and I can assure you it never stops being the most interesting thing you can do. As a result of having said, yes, I'll speak to the conference on the topic, of which I didn't even understand what she meant, let alone know anything about it, of course, I went away and tried to educate myself on wellbeing economics. So one of the things that I will do tonight is talk about, in brief, about what is wellbeing economics, what is its history, what does it seek to do? Because I thought I knew my economics very well for working knowledge as an IP lawyer, and IP lawyers have to understand economics, both the justifications, so the theory as well as the practice. But it turned out I'd missed this. I had a blind spot as to big evolution, big sub-branch of economics that had evolved in the late 20th century and was now having such a dominant role that whole countries, and I'll mention some in the United Kingdom equally doing this, that have sought to implement their policy, their economic and indeed their social policy around wellbeing economics. So that's something I will talk with you about. And then I'll turn to answer the primary question that I've been trying to grapple with over the last little while, and which is, well, what does this mean for patents law? What would it be like if, in fact, we sought, and indeed I'll show you, we do, although I hadn't properly recognised it that way, if we sought to implement patent policy to achieve the aspirations of wellbeing economics, what would that look like? And in fact, I've seen that we are doing that in various sporadic ways, and I've tried to bring it all together and show you what it might look like. So how might our patent law look? What could we do to achieve the aspirations of wellbeing economics? But before I do that, I want to just go briefly to patents themselves. Some of you in the room will have only just started your exposure to them. And I find a lot of my legal colleagues who aren't IP lawyers are quite surprised to know that it's a niche area, but B, it's a really significant area. So have a look at that. 3.5+ million patents are applied for annually around the world. And that equates to more than 2 million unique inventions for which patents are sought. Now, economists tell us that an application for a patent is a proxy for an innovation occurring. Why? Because somebody believes they've done something that's new, involves an inventive step that's useful, and they're going to spend the time and the money to seek a patent for it. Of course, there's a vast range of innovation that occurs for which patents are not sought, but we can know there's at least 2 million unique inventions annually for which people are willing to stump up non-trivial amounts of money, time, and effort to try and acquire exclusive rights of a patent. So it reflects what I think we all intuitively know, which is there's a lot of innovation that's occurring, okay? And the patent system is there to reflect and accommodate that. And you'll see that a couple of things from this graph. Firstly, again, a lot of my legal colleagues who aren't IP lawyers are surprised to know that, in fact, intellectual property is about the oldest area of law. Okay, so we've had over 400 years of statutes clearly on patenting, for example, Statute of Monopoly 1623. How many other areas of law can trace their genesis so clearly back that far? Not the case in the UK anymore, but in Australia, we still expressly refer to the Statute of Monopolies. We say patentable subject matter is subject matter within the meaning of Section 6 of the Statute of Monopolies 1623. So patent law, like IP law generally, is a very old area of law. And it's also about the first area of law to be internationalised, to be the subject of international treaties, which is why this graph can go back to 1883, which is when the Paris Convention was initiated. The Paris Convention established the Paris Union, which member countries reciprocally recognised certain things to do with IP. And I've been told, and I think it is correct, that the only other treaty, international treaty, that precedes the Paris Convention is the treaty that established the Postal Union. Now, I've never turned my mind to the Postal Union other than to realise that the significance of that to intellectual property. So back in the late 19th century, countries realised that it would be quite handy if there was reciprocity, recognising that a letter that was addressed and put had a stamp in France, but that was addressed to England, would be delivered by the English Postal Service once it arrived across the Channel. And England agreed to do that. So in return for France agreeing to deliver a letter that was addressed and had a stamp put on in England addressed to France, even though the countries didn't receive the financial benefit of the stamp, that in delivering country didn't get any money for delivering the letter, but they got the benefit of reciprocity. What's the relevance of that to IP? Well, it shows you why we need international treaties on IP, because letters move across boundaries. People post parcels and letters across boundaries, and ideas, which is what intellectual property deals with, they move across boundaries even more easily. So no surprise come the late 19th century that the second, essentially, international treaty was to do with IP. Okay, so that graph shows you history of IP just internationally goes back late 19th century, and it shows you how significant the growth in patenting has been in the 21st century. And you can look at the colours on the graph and you can observe, no surprise, that that growth has been predominantly contributed to by countries in the Asian region. Initially, Japan, then Korea, and now, no surprise, China. Patents can last, with one exception, up to a maximum of 20 years. And because of that, and we know that roughly, on average, a patent will last for half the maximum duration. Typically, a patent, on average, will last for 10 years. And we can estimate, therefore, that there's nearly 19 million patents currently in force. So that's non-trivial. It's non-trivial. 19 million patents in force at the moment and growing, because we're getting 3.5 million plus applications a year. This area is not going to go away. Okay, so if you suddenly find, hey, patents is what I want to do, I love it, you'll have, there'll be work for you to do, don't worry. It's not tailing down the amount of patenting activity, and it's certainly not tailing down in your region. Okay, so the EPO, which is a beyond European organization, but I'll just loosely say predominantly European countries, is a top five office, and the United Kingdom's own IP office is a top 12 IP office. So no fear that that patents are something you, if you want to work in, you will find there's plenty of work that you can do. Now, if we turn to look at the traditional rationales, and I'm sure that if you've been studying this week, I think you have, you might say that what I'm going to show you is a little bit simplified. True, okay? Because I want to get onto the detail when I get to economics. But I'll start with a couple of the traditionally regarded rationales for IP, which will be familiar, I suspect, to almost all of you in the room and online. And it's to do with old white men. So we'll start with John Locke and his second treatise on government from 1690 talked about the idea that there was a natural right, a moral right that rose naturally for somebody who expends their labour to produce something. So in relation to commonly or unowned material. So a fisher who sails their boat out into the sea, casts their net, pulls in fish, brings them back onto land, owns those fish because they've exercised their labour as part of acquiring it. And that alone gives them rights to fish, to the fish they've caught. You can see how that applies to intellectual property law. Let's take copyright. Let's use a slightly strained metaphor. Talk about a composer who casts their net into the sea of musical notes. The musical notes are commonly owned or unowned, i.e. nobody specifically owns the whole sea of notes. They pull out from that sea of notes a musical composition. By virtue of having exercised labour, they have a natural moral right to control that particular, in this case, composition that they've created. And so Lockean labour theory takes us some way along the path. It clearly has application in relation to intellectual property of the type of that we're concerned with tonight, inventions. It does a reasonable amount of work. Added to that, Hegelian thought about the fact that emanations of the personality or the mind are such that should always be able to be controlled by the person who generated those emanations, and intellectual property is an emanation of the human intellect. Thereby, we should be able to recognise that the person who exercises their mental labour, not only by virtue of exercising labour, but the fact that it's inherent to them, it reflects to a degree their personality, should control. That latter one perhaps less clearly applicable to inventions. It's not typically the case that an inventor will say, that new mousetrap reflects my personality. So maybe that's not the strongest of justifications. But what I think undoubtedly is the strongest of justifications, typically for both or for all areas of intellectual property and particularly for patents, is the economic paradigm. I think I've seen since the 20th century and well into the 21st century that policymakers almost always talk about intellectual property through the lens of economics. It's rare to hear them talk about Locke or Hegel, rare to hear them talk about labor theory or personality theory, almost always seen as an economic tool. And that's fair enough, because intellectual property has two characteristics about it, or intellectual property law has two characteristics about it. I think you will be an easy audience to persuade if you need any persuasion. You may not. I have absolutely no doubt, and I tell anybody who'll listen, and even people who won't listen, I tell, that intellectual property law is the most important area of law. Absolutely the most important area of law. Humankind has got itself into dire straits, global warming, inability to feed the populace, et cetera, et cetera. Pandemic viruses wreaking havoc. The solution to those challenges comes from only one place. It's only one solution. It's the human intellect. Some people might say if we eventually get artificial general intelligence, but even then it will be relying on the human intellect to have programmed artificial general intelligence. So the solutions can only come from one place. If we're going to deal with global warming, it can only be dealt with through the human intellect. And intellectual property law is that regime, it's that regulatory tool which seeks to maximize creativity and innovation at the same time as maximizing access to it for the human benefit. So it's the most important area of law, no doubt. End of no debate will be entered by me. There's no point worrying about human rights if we're dead, right? Humankind's become extinct. Human rights are of no use. Intellectual property law is the most important area. The other good thing about it is also the most interesting area. And the reason is because it deals with intangibles. That you see there on the screen, the picture of the front page of Dickens's manuscript, that literally his handwritten manuscript, first part of Great Expectations in the Wisbech Library. If you go and have a look at it, they won't let you touch it because, you know, human hands will destroy the paper, et cetera, et cetera. That's tangible. That's sitting in a museum. But what's intangible is the story, if I can put it so crudely, that manuscript embodies. And that can be shown on a e-reader or anywhere. That's the intangible aspect. Now, we know this, but sometimes it's just worth being reminded how bluntly different intellectual subject matter and intellectual property is from tangible subject matter and tangible property. And the reason it's really important to remember that is when you turn to the economic justifications, what you find is that they are the ones on the right. Intellectual subject matter, intangible subject matter, is non-rivalrous, non-exhaustible, and non-excludable. That's that's the words the economists use. It's just fancy words to say that any number of people at any one time can use the story of Great Expectations, even though only one person at one time can hold the manuscript of it. Unlike the manuscript, the story never wears out over time. And unlike the manuscript, which is locked up in a museum, the story cannot be locked up. You cannot lock up an intangible. The only way you can lock it up is using legal locks, which is what intellectual property laws are. And the economists recognize that because they know that the nature of an intangible is such that because you can't lock it up, because it doesn't wear out, because any number of people at any one time can take use of it, you'll get an underinvestment in creation of that subject matter compared to demand. And when you get an underinvestment compared to demand, you end up with what is called very sort of crude, I love the phrase because it can tell us a bad thing, a dead weight loss. Now, dead weight loss is bad because nobody wants to lose stuff, anything. You lose money, you don't like it. Weight, apparently, we're all seeking to have less of it, and being dead is not a good thing. So a dead weight loss is a bad thing. And a dead weight loss is what economists want us to avoid. And I'm going to show you yet another old white man. I chose Arnold Harberger because he's the person after whom those yellow triangles are named. They're called Harberger triangles. Now, he didn't invent the concept of a dead weight loss. Economists have known this for a very long period of time, but he invented the concept of calling out those triangles in yellow. We don't want them. We don't want dead weight loss. And yet, without intellectual property laws, the economists tell us, we will get it, because we'll get an underinvestment in innovation and creation because free riding doesn't allow the innovator creator to reap the benefit they need from the investment they've incurred. For that, at that point, I can stop and say, well, that's the story of the justification for intellectual property law. A couple of moral ones to do with labor and personality, and then ones that all the real ones, the economists will tell us, the only ones that really matter, the ones that policymakers focus on, it's all to do with avoiding deadweight loss. Avoid free riding produces deadweight loss. Let's stop free riding. Let's provide legal locks that can lock up intangibles so that we can have an element of control exercised and a return on the investment in creation delivered. That's where I got to. So when I got the phone call asking me to speak about wellbeing economics, no wonder I had no idea, because I would have said, oh, that's all the justifications you need to have for intellectual property. And the president was asking me to talk about something, and I thought, well, I don't know anything about it, but let's find out. So let's find out. Let's find out what this other view is. What's wellbeing economics? It's often said that it began with Jeremy Bentham. His Introduction to the Principles of Morals and Legislation of 1789 said that there's 12 pains that a human can suffer and 14 pleasures that they can receive. And his view was that we should try, in that famous phrase, to get the greatest good of the greatest number, maximize the amount of pleasure for the maximum number of people. That's what our law should be aspiring to. Now, I went and paid homage to the great man not being the one on the left, but the one on the right. I was in London yesterday, so I thought I should go to the UCL Student Centre where the auto icon of Jeremy Bentham resides. It's his skeleton, it's his clothes, his hat. It's not his head, because when they tried to preserve his head using New Zealand Māori techniques of preservation of skulls, they overcooked it and the flesh just basically disappeared. So that's a wax head of Jeremy Bentham, but on his skeleton, dressed in his clothes, with his hat, in the Student Centre at University College London, and me paying homage and taking a selfie. So that's where we start. Now, at that point, it goes, well, okay, that makes sense, doesn't it? Maximise the pleasure, minimise the pain for a maximum number of people. The trouble is, economists couldn't do it. It's all very messy when you try to measure individual pain and pleasure and then sum it. So what economists did instead is what they can do. And you've probably heard this aphorism, this joke, but I'll tell you, it's not really a joke. It's actually a statement of fact, but dressed up as a joke. And I know this because I've worked with a lot of economists over the decades. There's an economist standing under a light looking down at the ground, and somebody comes up and says, what are you doing? He says, I'm looking for my keys. Person says, oh, did you drop them over here? He said, no, I dropped them over there. Person says, well, why are you looking here? And he goes, well, because the light's so much better. Now, what that's telling you is economists just, where the light is, where the data is, where the numbers are, that's where they'll do the work, even if they know it's not really measuring much of relevance. So they look for their keys in the place where the light's good, not where they drop them. And what they decided they could do was measure spending. Can't measure what humans actually experience as pleasure and pain. What they can do is they can measure what humans spend their money on. And that's essentially what gross national product is, and its slightly later variant gross domestic product is. It's a measure of what humans spend money on. And economists for a long time have taken the view But that therefore measures what's important, because we all know we're trying to increase GDP. Our politicians say that as well. But, and I'll let the quote do the talking, because I think the quote says it all. So it's not as if no one realised that GNP or GDP, very similar measures, is flawed. You know, another way, and politicians have observed this, the best way to increase GDP is to engage in a war. Second best way to increase it is to have some natural phenomenon wreak havoc on your country. Because with war, you engage in a lot of production of armaments. And with when you're recovering from a natural disaster, you're spending a lot of money to rebuild, to clean, etc. The GDP of the Gaza Strip will be huge, right? But it doesn't reflect much well-being in Gaza with that destroyed area. So economists know Bentham's aspirations have been what they would like to do, but it took them a long time to try and work out how to measure it. But it did happen in the 1980s. Amartya Sen said, let's think about development, economic development in a different way. Stop thinking about it in terms of what we produce and spend money on. Let's think about it. And once you hear it, it's so obvious. I didn't know it. What people are able to do with their lives. But he calls that the capabilities approach. And in fact, a friend of his and a former Pakistani finance minister called Mahab al-Haq joined the United Nations Development Programme in 1989 with the express task of trying to get away from measuring economic development through GNP, GDP, and measure it through what people can do with their lives. And indeed, in 1990, in a rather breakthrough achievement, the United Nations Development Programme released what it called its Human Development Index. Now, it's still going, and it's largely in this form. It's a bit more fleshed out. But I'm going to show you in a minute a more recent version of that from a particular country, and you'll note how elaborated it's become over the last 20, 25, 30 years. In 1990, the way economists could measure human development through the new lens was by looking at three dimensions: health, knowledge, and standard of living. And those had one indicator each, and knowledge had two. You can see from the slides what they are: life expectancy at birth, expected years of schooling and mean years of schooling, and gross national income per capita. And with that measurement, we could then start comparing countries on a meaningful basis. What's the quality of life people in each country, not how much stuff gets produced? And this was the beginning of well-being economics in its modern form. Now, many countries then took on the challenge of trying to introduce equivalent indices at the domestic level. And the most recent one that I've looked at is, in fact, from my country, Australia, where the Treasury released in a couple of years ago what it called the Measuring What Matters framework. Now, this is expanded out. No longer is it three dimensions, four indicators. It's 50 indicators, five themes, one cross-cutting dimension. But you can see what's happening, that economists are now trying to identify and then measure what they say really matters. And you can measure those things. There's data now that we can access for those sorts of indicators and come up with a measurement of each individual country in using the Australian measurement, whether Australia's improving on what matters or going backwards. And then what policymakers are saying they need to do and are doing, although perhaps there's maybe the enthusiasm's fallen off a little bit as the doing is not as easy as we would like it to be, is to take this framework and change policy, including change law. So for example, I'll just take two initiatives from the British Isles. We've got Scotland has developed its wellbeing economy toolkit, which it says that all government instrumentalities when coming up with new policies need to use the toolkit, which tells them how to assess whether or not the change in policy is going to be good for wellbeing. And Wales, in fact, has mandated this through legislation. Public authorities are obliged under the Wellbeing of Future Generations Wales Act 2015 to ensure that the seven goals, which is a prosperous Wales, a resilient Wales, a healthier Wales, a more equal Wales, a more cohesive Wales, a Wales with a vibrant culture and language, and a globally responsible Wales, that that is what legislation is seeking to do. So all of this was a surprise to me. I had no idea that I didn't even know about what had happened in the UNDP, didn't know that Australia had spent 25 years developing its own version, come out with this, because the presentation was to be delivered in 2023, and that framework came out after the presentation, but I knew, learnt it was in the process. Didn't know that countries had developed toolkits for assessing policy ambitions against actions. Didn't know that a country, Wales, had mandated this in its legislation. But once I did note it, once I did realise it, I then turned my mind to this question. So how could we implement the aspirations of wellbeing through patents? Okay, these things of which there's 3.5 million applications a year, you know, 18.5 million patents currently in force. How do we actually seek to enhance and achieve the aspirations of human well-being? And I had no idea. I was still backing with the yellow triangles, going, well, we've got to cut out deadweight loss, we've got to prevent free riding, allow a fair return for the creator innovator on their investment. And that's the economic world had moved on, and my mindset was still back here. And I think, having talked to a range of IP people, at least in Australia, that their mindset was back with mine as well. So let me, in the last part of this presentation, and I won't go through the whole lot of this, let me just turn to look at, well, how could we and how do we implement policy in patent law? What are our levers, as the Americans would say? What are the levers? What are the levers we have? And what are the constraints we have? And the constraints most of us in the room will be aware are the international constraints that are imposed by the TRIPS agreement, although brackets, they're not very constraining, and the levers, I've categorized into six groups: the things that patents can be granted for, the advancement thresholds that those things have to achieve to be entitled to be granted, the nature of the exclusive rights that are granted that give protection for those subject matters, exceptions to those rights, how long those rights last for, and how we allow people to achieve those rights. They're the six levers that I can see. And in a minute, I'm going to invite you to tell me which one you would like me to pull. And I'll pull the lever, and you can see what options we have. In fact, why don't I do that now? Who wants to pull a lever? Which one do you want to pull?
Yes.
Grant procedures? Let's go to grant procedures. Okay. So, I'm drawing on real things that already happen. And believe it or not, these are from the US. So the US, which we often think of the least adventurous, the least sort of interested in this sort of stuff way back in the yellow triangles, itself has introduced accelerated processing of patent applications and discounted fees for patent applications in certain areas that it wants to incentivize. Climate change mitigation, for example, although brackets in April, guess who? Climate change, unfortunately called climate change mitigation program, should have called it something else. Trump's taken this one off. But for a number of years, the US Patent Office expedited examination of applications for inventions that dealt with mitigating climate change. Why? Because it's one of the great challenges humanity faces. We will be better off if we can mitigate climate change effects. We should incentivize innovations in that space. One tiny way of doing it is through accelerated examination of applications for patents in that area. And similarly, reducing or waiving fees in those areas. So that's one thing that the patent offices can, and for example, the US actually does. Yeah.
So when you're talking about accelerated processing of grants, so in India, basically, so the patent office has set a definite number of targets for the patent examiners to go through in a in an annual year. So does that not affect the quality of the patents that are being granted? If you're looking at accelerated processes, if you're looking at targets to meet, would that also not make patents futile as well?
It could. So in case the recording hasn't picked up the observation, I'll try and summarize, and it'll probably be too summarized, but the reference was to, in India, patent examiners are encouraged to have a certain amount of throughput. They have targets. Indeed, all patent offices that I'm aware of do likewise. Does that affect the quality of examination? May or may not. Depends how many patent examiners you have. Would something like accelerated processing have a negative effect on quality of examination in other areas? Not necessarily. It's a question of, you might delay the non-significant applications, the applications in areas that you don't think are particularly significant, by focusing on the ones you're seeking to accelerate. But yeah.
In India, what has happened is, because of this expedition, there have been a lot more symptoms of litigations as well. At the same time, a number of patents being accepted going high,
yep,
also meant a large number of litigations have also gone high, challenging those patents as well.
Fair enough. Thank you for that observation. What other lever should we... Where's my lever page? Sorry, I've got the numbers for the levers, but I haven't got it for the page. It's, which lever do you want me to push? Pull, I should say. Which one? Who's a lever? Yes.
Protectable subject matter.
Say that again.
Protectable subject matter.
Oh, protectable subject matters. Thanks, Natalie. Okay. This is a quite a substantive lever, actually. It's one that I spend the most time proselytizing about. It's got two components. One, expanding the range of protectable subject matter, and guess what the other one is? Reducing the type of subject matter can protect it. I'm going to proselytize on both. Let's take the first one. WHO says that more than 1 billion people globally suffering from poor mental health. And I know in Australia, there's what people are referring to as an epidemic of poor mental health. Now, whether it's a flow on from COVID lockdowns or whether it's just social media platforms or whatever, it's generally recognised there's an epidemic of poor mental health. So maybe what would be a good idea would be to incentivise innovation, including inventions, in the area that improve mental health. As it happens, this is an area that generally patents are not available for, because patent officers, when they look at what constitutes patentable subject matter, are looking for inventions that have a technological effect. Okay, the European Patent Convention looking for, EPO looking for a technical effect. Other officers, and you can take examples in the computer implemented invention areas or whatever. You can take one directly from mental health. That's from a mental health application that was refused in Europe, Australia, et cetera. So it seems to me that if we've got an epidemic of poor mental health, we might be wanting to focus on encouraging innovation of treatments for mental health beyond the pharmacological. Now, pharmacological treatments are patentable. That's drugs. That's pharmaceuticals. Patent system works brilliantly for pharmaceuticals. Doesn't work at all for non-technological inventions like psychological treatments. And that one, essentially, it was called rational inquiry method. That's a figure from the actual application that got refused in a range of patent offices, lacked technical effect. I reckon if you rocked up with a very effective psychological treatment, patent system's not for you. You won't be allowed. So possibly we're failing to incentivize some very important interventions here, because what patent officers do is they say an invention has to have a technical effect. But the TRIPS agreement doesn't say you can't patent things that don't have a technical effect. All the TRIPS agreement says is that you must make patents available for inventions in any field of technology. But it doesn't say, and no other field. So fields that aren't technological can, you're not constrained by the TRIPS agreement from offering the incentive of patents there. And I think treatment of poor mental health is a very important thing. We should be seeking to maximise innovation in that space. The patent system possibly has a role to play there. How could it play that role? Break out of the constraint, expand the range of patentable subject matter to subject matter that doesn't have a technical effect, but might have a very productive effect on human well-being. For example, it might be a very effective psychological treatment. The other one, Natalie, when I pull the lever, is excluding inventions from patentability. Now here, proselytization occurs. So TRIPS agreement, as I think most of us in the room are aware, Article 27, subsection 2, tells us countries are entitled to, can preclude from patenting inventions contrary to ordre public or morality. In Australia, the biggest domestic filer of patents is a company called Aristocrat. What's Aristocrat make? Electronic gaming machines. It's one of the world's biggest electronic gaming machine manufacturers. Now, I'm not a wowser, right? I'm going to have a drink of wine later tonight. I occasionally put a bet on Australian rules football. So I'm not a wowser. But I can tell you what, I am really against electronic gaming machines. They've been called the crack cocaine of gambling. They are incredibly addictive. Incredibly addictive. They're incredibly efficient at pulling money from people's pockets. In Australia, which has a population of 26 million, so about a third of Britain, annually, and this is figures from a few years ago, and it won't have gone down, $15 billion annually is lost to playing electronic gaming machines. That's £7.5 billion annually in a country the size of Australia. It's crack cocaine for gambling. They're highly addictive. And these patents that Aristocrat applies for and often gets are to what they call enhanced player enjoyment. Now, enhancing player enjoyment means making them more addictive. I don't think the patent system should be incentivizing making electronic gaming machines more addictive. I don't. Personal view, putting it out there, I don't. It's not enhancing human well-being to increase the addictiveness of these sorts of things. And you can come up with a million other variants, you know, making illegal drugs even more addictive. Let's make heroin, cocaine even more addictive. Is that what we want to incentivize? No. And TRIPS allows all countries to do this, but Australia doesn't, and many, many countries, the US doesn't take advantage of it either. So I reckon that's an example of where the patent system could, and I'm going to say personally should, change and can change under TRIPS to preclude the patenting of these sorts of inventions. And I'm not a wowser, right? And I look, and I'm sure you'll say things like, oh, yes, but we can have laws against that sort of stuff. We can have laws against illegal drugs, and we could ban EGMs if we wanted to. And I'm saying to you, okay, fine, if that works. But it's still a really bad look when a nation state like Australia says, over here, innovators, look over here, 20-year monopoly available for you if you can make electronic gaming machines even more addictive. I don't think that's good public policy, right? And it's not, because it's just making Australians lose more money. Aristocrat, the biggest filer of patents in Australia, a big filer of patents in the US, I went and counted them, thousands of patents in the US, thousands of patents in Australia, all for one thing, making their electronic gaming machines having enhanced player enjoyment more addictive. Another leader. Which lever would you like me to pull?
Protection duration.
Protection duration. Thank you for that. Protection duration. Let's pull that lever and see what could happen. Okay. So we know that TRIPS mandates a minimum maximum. Do you know what I mean? It says patents must be available for at least 20 years. Now, it's not obligatory for a patentee to take full period of protection. And as I say, most don't. Average patent would last about 10 years. They drop off because they have to pay renewal fees, and renewal fees rise over time. The idea is to keep out from the full duration inventions that don't justify it, i.e. that they're no longer commercially justifiable to pay the increased patent fees. And that's how the system works. It's a well-calibrated system. But TRIPS doesn't say you can't offer patents for longer than 20 years. It just says you must be able to offer up to a maximum of 20 years. And countries, US, Europe, Australia, Japan, whole heap of countries, in fact, do offer longer periods of protection. It's the asterisk that I mentioned when I said at the very start, general patents last for a maximum of 20 years. Now, at the moment, that system of extending patent protection called patent term extensions applies effectively solely to pharmaceuticals. Why? Because it's recognised that, you know, the time taken to generate all your clinical data to show that the drug doesn't kill people, in fact, saves their lives, et cetera, to get regulatory approval, that takes time. You can't bring a product to market until you've got regulatory approval. That eats into the effective patent life. We need to compensate by adding a bit on at the end. That's what we do. We can do that for any invention. It doesn't have to be limited to pharmaceuticals. We could offer, if you want to take psychological treatments to improve mental health, we could offer patents for a maximum of 50 years. We thought that was going to be a good thing to do. And even with things that have regulatory, there's plenty of areas of innovation that have that require regulatory approval beyond pharmaceuticals, medical devices, veterinary medicines, pesticides. There's a lot of area in which innovations occur beyond pharmaceuticals, which have a regulatory approval approach. And therefore, we could and we do with pharmaceuticals expand the period of protection to increase the incentive for making innovations in those areas. So choose an area that you think we're under-incentivized through the patent system. A way to improve the incentives is to offer longer periods of protection. Nothing in TRIPS precludes that. Another lever. Anyone else want to have another lever pulled? Yes, you can have another go.
Advancement thresholds.
I couldn't hear, sorry.
Advancement thresholds.
Oh, advancement thresholds. Okay, thanks for that. We'll have a look at advancement thresholds. Nation states have been increasing advanced thresholds by raising them. So again, there's two options, raise them and lower them. Why might you raise them? Because you want to cut it, as the Australian Productivity Commission, which is the economic policy arm of government, says you want to separate the wheat from the chaff. They're worried that there's a whole lot of low-value junk patents being granted, which get in the way of true of meaningful innovation. So they want to, and they forced Australia to, or forced, they've encouraged, they've persuaded the Australian policymakers over the last two decades to increasingly raise the innovation threshold, been raised quite a bit. I'm just going to choose one. There's not much. I was thinking, how else could we raise the innovation threshold? Another way is to think about the prior art against which we judge novelty. Okay. Now, most of you are aware that nowadays almost all countries use an international novelty test. They judge whether the claimed invention is new against that which already exists anywhere in the world. But during the 20th century, for a long time, many countries had domestic novelty. The test was, is this a claim to a subject matter that is new compared with that which already exists in this country? Okay, so we've seen this novelty threshold raise over time from domestic in this country to international in any country. And I was thinking, well, can't really raise the threshold any further, can we? And I thought, well, yes, we can. What about a celestial bodies? I mean, at the moment, I don't know if any patent office would treat existing subject matter on Mars or even the moon, which this is a shot of the moon, as being in the jurisdiction against which novelty is assessed. Now, this is more of theoretical at the moment rather than practical, but we might have to think about this, because if we find that we're having junk patents being sought in areas where it's in relation to subject matter that already exists on a celestial body, and our prior art area is treated as the world, the Earth, then maybe we need to raise the threshold. But I think more practically relevant is the converse, which is lowering the threshold. Because in fact, some innovations that we might wish to encourage might never reach the threshold, the standard threshold of an inventive step, just separate from novelty. And if that's the case, now let's say it was proving hard for psychological treatments, I'll keep coming back to that one, psychological treatments to establish that they involve an inventive step of the type that the major patenting jurisdictions around the world understand. We can lower that. There's nothing preventing us lowering that. And in fact, you may or may not be familiar with this, but many countries have. They have second-tier patent system, utility model system, or a second-tier patent system, where the whole point of the second-tier patent system is to have a lower threshold that's easier to satisfy by certain innovations. So this is not, theoretical, what about something on the moon? Is that prior art? This is practical. And we've had this for a long time, sometimes for a century or more. So don't forget, my point here is to us all, don't forget that you don't have to have novelty and inventive step as your two thresholds, often hard to satisfy for certain types of innovation. You can lower those thresholds if you want to. You could take them away. And you do that through a second-tier patent system, which many countries have. And that example I've given of not clearly lacking, that comes from the Irish Patent Act. The Irish Patent Act, Section 63, Subsection 4, has a special field called short-term patents, and it lowers the innovation threshold to make subject matter more easily patentable. So that's the two arms of this lever, two outputs. Raise thresholds if you think that's important, keep out junk. Lower them if you think that's important to incentivize new areas. Yes.
Chair, I think it's the balance between two different pools that you had until now. The first one is the subject matter one, and the second one, the threshold. Because I know that there are patents that we would not say are that innovative or that novel. For example, the everyday kind of inventions. And I was in a lecture of Professor George Lerpes from the University of Ottawa a year and a half ago. And then he talked about inventions by women, for example. That's in, for example, the 19th century, many women tried to create inventions, to invent things that we would not think as inventions in the previous century necessarily. But then when we lower the threshold of novelty, when they said that something very simple, for example, for a box, like the magnet can be considered as an invention. But then how does it fit with the subject matter? Because we don't have kind of a niche, like we can say environmental, as you said, inventions, but how do you call the everyday one? So I'm interested to know, how do you see these two pools maybe working together?
Thank you.
We thought about this example, but I can see I can see more examples that this have potential.
No, thank you, Inba. They're good points. So in other words, when you've got multiple levers, can they all be pulled independently, or some interact with each other, or some preclude each other? I'm saying these are all independent. You can do all of them if you want to. If you want to incentivize through expanding the range of subject matter, reducing the threshold, increasing the scope of exclusive rights, and also increasing the acts that don't constitute infringement, and increasing the duration protection, and minimizing, time and fees. You can do it all for anything. They're all, as far as I'm concerned, they're all independent. So they may co-act, but they're not correlated in the sense that one precludes the other, or one must be done with the other. That would be my observation to that. So when you're thinking about a particular area where you want to increase the incentives for innovation, think of all the levers, not just one or two. Don't forget they're all available, and some of them will work. They will. You can pull them in different directions, but that's the beauty. You can craft your patent policy, you craft your patent law very subtly. I mean, any other lever want to be pulled? Go on.
Infringement exceptions.
Infringement exceptions? Great. Let's go and have a look at that. And I think by looking at infringement exceptions, we'll get a sense of how these things can be subtly pulled. Okay. So these are real examples that already happen. They're not necessarily seen as part of trying to implement well-being economics policy through the patent system, but I'm telling you that is the effect, which is that we want to allow follow-on innovation. We want to encourage follow-on innovation. What do I mean by that? I mean an innovation that builds on another one. Now, in theory, and subject to infringement exceptions, that might be precluded. If person A has made drug A. Person B wants to make an improvement, whether it be to you know, change the formulation or the delivery mechanism or something like that. Person B, to do that innovation, may have to make use of drug A and therefore infringe person A's patent rights over drug A. That's a bad thing, right? We all know we want innovation to build on innovation. We know that, you know. Was it referring to someone from Ian Newton said to Hooke in a letter, if I've seen further, it's because I've stood on the shoulder of giants, right? Everything builds on everything going. That's good. That is good. So what we have to do, and we do have it in our patent laws, we have exceptions to infringement. And here's an example, one that allows follow-on innovation. It could be an experimental use exception in the common law. Could be. Arguably, English, British patent common law has experimental use exception. Arguably, Australian law does. Arguably, in a narrow form, American law does. But we also have statutory exceptions as well. So the Americans will be familiar with this if I use the phrase Ebola exemption. Ebola exemption is an exemption from infringement that's granted to follow-on innovators in relation to pharmaceuticals to allow them to exercise an exclusive right of the patentee in relation to the patented pharmaceutical so that they can generate the data to allow application for their follow-on innovation. So even America, the country we tend to think, oh, you know, they're so strong on patent rights, don't like any exceptions, you know, don't want any of this woke stuff. Most of my examples come from America. So Ebola exemption is an example. Many countries have it. More than 40 countries have the equivalent of a Ebola exemption. And that says it's not an act of infringement to do something in relation to a patented invention if the purpose of the doing is to generate data for a regulatory approval application in relation to a follow-on invention. But we also have, and really importantly, and this will, given the time, this will be my last example. We've pulled every lever that you wanted pulled, not every lever that exists, is increasing access to inventions. Now, we've had one of the best real examples of this in recent times. Nobody wanted it. Nobody wanted COVID-19 to wreak havoc on the world, but when it did, we've seen how the patent system can respond. And I was saying to someone the other day, it's not just COVID-19. I can remember after 9/11, I was living in the US when 9/11 happened. And then following on that, there were these sort of crazy people sending anthrax through the mail. And the US government immediately announced, said, forgotten which German pharmaceutical company had the treatment for anthrax poisoning. Ciproflaxin is the drug. Said, if we can't get full amounts of ciproflaxin in here, we're going to take advantage of our compulsory licensing provisions, which they have. Bayer immediately said, don't worry, US government, every amount of ciproflaxin you want, we will supply to you. We'll target you once you've other markets. So it wasn't just COVID. It was anthrax poisoning through the mail. It's any of these national emergencies, countries have and do take advantage of their ability to have a compulsory license granted. Yes, it's remunerated, true, but it's still compulsory. It's against the wishes of the patentee. Why do we do that? Because we want to increase access to innovation. If we don't think enough people are getting treated, what are you going to do? Your government's going to take a compulsory license. And can it? Yes, it can. Why? Because that's what TRIPS Article 31 allows. And it's in the TRIPS agreement already. So my final lever for tonight, at least, is exceptions to infringement. What are we trying to do there? What would we try and do with well-being as our aspiration for patent policy to achieve? We would want to encourage follow-on innovation. We already do with exceptions. And we would want to permit full access to inventions, particularly in national emergency situations, but not just limited to that. And we do. Okay, so I'm going to, within 1 minute, conclude, and we'll have finished, I think, pretty much right on time. So my conclusion goes like this. Patent law exists to achieve policy objectives. That is a no-brainer. Everyone knows that. It's not there just because it's fun. I love patent law, but it's not there for me to enjoy. It's there to do stuff, to achieve policy objectives. What are those policy objectives? predominantly they have been economic. What is the economic objective been predominantly until, you know, the last couple of decades? It was about what I would call economic well-being rather than well-being economics. Economic well-being is about increasing the amount of stuff, and so patent law would have said, we're about increasing the amount of innovation, which looks right, looks good. Patents are there to increase innovation that we can all access. Well-being economics enhances our understanding of that. It says, well, it's not really there just to increase innovation. It's there to increase innovation that improves human well-being. And we now know how to identify the relevant indicators and we can measure it. Once we can measure it, we can start changing patent policy to achieve it. How do we do that? We identify what levers we have and we identify what constraints we have on those levers. The levers are many, the constraints are very limited. Therefore, it beholds our policymakers and us to inform them that that's what they need to do. That's what the patent law now needs to be aspiring to. To enhance human well-being. If it's not there for that, then it's not doing the right thing. End of sermon.